You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 482 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Our very special guest this week is Sebastian Ospina, who joins us from Interlaken in Switzerland. Thank you to Jonathan Munoz for putting us into contact. Sebastian is a world champion parasender, or parasending is his sport. He's Colombian, originally from the region of Armenia, but he flies for Team GB in competitions, in international competitions. So we'll hear all about that and how, of course, the sport evolves and what is the sport. How do they possibly give you a medal for this? I don't know. I mean, that this is what has to be explained by Sebastian there, and how someone makes a living by parasending and so on. So really interesting conversation, a nice, pleasant story from Colombia, about a Colombian here on this week's Colombia Calling podcast. Because next week we come back with, well, a pretty serious episode with Ricardo Cubides talking about paramilitarism in the area of the Canal del Dique. So that's an area near to Cartagena. Of course, completely overlooked and unfortunately in the news for all the wrong reasons. And Ricardo is the director for the Caribbean region of CODES, which is an NGO, Colombian NGO. And he's only talking to us because he's getting to talk in English. Were it in Spanish, he would not give the interview. But that's next week. This week is Sebastian Ospina talking about parasending and the life as a parasending expert in Switzerland and flying for TGB. Thank you to all of you who signed up on patreon.com/Columbia Calling to support us. We've had a couple of new Patreons. And indeed, you do get most episodes a week early via our channel on YouTube. So if you are a Patreon, that is one of your perks, alongside other things such as tote bags and sweatshirts and so on and so forth, should you pledge more. Anyhow, so Emily and I are, of course, incredibly grateful to all of you for this. And now we'll go over to Emily with the news and then come back with Sebastian Ospina in Interlaken, Switzerland, talking about the life and times of being a parasending expert. So thank you again, and don't go away. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for the week of August 14th, 2023. One of Colombia's most notorious warlords has been sentenced to 45 years in prison in the United States. Dairo Antonio Usuga, known as Otoniel, was leader of armed group the Clan del Golfo and had a criminal career which spanned decades and various groups across the political and criminal spectrum, including both guerrilla and paramilitary. He is responsible for numerous war crimes, genocides, and murders, but his conviction in a New York court was on drug trafficking charges, namely the importation of around 100,000 kilograms of cocaine into the USA. Meanwhile, Otoniel has faced none of the 122 open criminal proceedings against him in Colombia, due to his extradition to the USA in 2021, despite attempts by his Colombian victims to keep him in the country to face justice here and give testimony relating to the Colombian armed conflict. Colombia's Attorney General, Francisco Barbosa, has accused guerrilla group the ELN, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, of an assassination plot against him. Evidence has emerged of an apparent payment of 3 billion pesos for the attack, and the snipers due to be involved have also been identified. The plan reportedly also included the murder of right-wing Senator Maria Fernanda Cabal and retired Army General Eduardo Zapatero. The ELN say that the accusation is false, calling it an attempt to sabotage ongoing peace talks during the ceasefire. Barbosa has been among the most vocal critics of the government's policy of total peace. The ELN, however, violated the ceasefire 6 times in the first 10 days, Colombia's armed forces have reported. Nevertheless, the 4th round of peace talks will begin this week in Venezuela. Additionally, a date has been set for negotiations with FARC dissident group the Estado Mayor Central, starting on September 17th. A dialogue table will be set up and a 6-month bilateral ceasefire will begin the same day. And the Odebrecht scandal continues in Colombia with the announcement that Grupo Aval and Corfi Colombiana will be sanctioned by the USA for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act via bribes to Colombian officials. The US says there were at least $28 million in illicit payments with the knowledge, approval, and assistance of the former president of Corfi Colombiana. Both companies are listed on the New York Stock Exchange and thus are subject to US law. For this reason, Corfi Colombiana will pay $20 million US to the Department of Justice. Grupo Aval will pay a further $40 million. Meanwhile, President Gustavo Petro has been in Brazil at the Summit of Amazonian Countries, where he decried climate denialism from elements of the political left in the region and continued to advocate suspending hydrocarbon exploration and exploitation. This is the first summit in 14 years for the 8-nation group, which was set up in 1995. The summit is also being seen as a dress rehearsal for the 2025 United Nations climate talks. The host, President of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, called on the European Union to stop making promises and deliver funds to the countries which protect the Amazon. The official statement also called on the Global North to accelerate decarbonization of economies and to implement a mechanism for swapping public debt for climate action commitments. The summit has, however, faced much criticism regarding the lack of concrete proposals, particularly around the failure to unite around promises to end deforestation, leaving countries instead to pursue individual deforestation goals. Meanwhile, Colombia's new Minister of Mines and Energy has announced that the country's oil exploration will continue, saying that it is key to the transition period, which must take place hand in hand with the oil industry. In the same week, Ecopetrol announced that a significant new oil deposit has been found in Putumayo. 100 social leaders have been killed in Colombia this year, according to Human Rights Watch. The majority of those murders in Cauca, Antioquia, and Nariño. Community and political leaders are the most threatened. Warnings are also starting to be made about security in relation to upcoming local elections. The National Registrar and Ombudsman have warned this week of pressure from armed groups, both on candidates and on voters. And the assassination of Ecuadorian presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio was reportedly perpetrated by Colombian nationals six of whom are currently detained, though the intellectual authors of the murder are still being pursued. The detained men are members of organised crime groups, according to Ecuadorian police. Villavicencio was a vocal critic of corruption and organised crime. He was killed on Wednesday in Quito, just 2 weeks before Ecuador's elections. He had built his career as a journalist by exposing corruption in the government of former president Rafael Correa. The media in Ecuador have called the assassination a Colombianization of Ecuadorian politics. Others are calling Ecuador the new Colombia, harking back to the political and mafia violence of the late 1980s and early 1990s, when five presidential candidates were assassinated. Current President Guillermo Lasso said that the crime was clearly an attempt to sabotage the elections, but that voting would go ahead as planned this Sunday, though amid a national state of emergency. A new poll by Invamer, Colombia's most trusted pollsters, has measured Petro's disapproval at 61%, more than 40% higher than in August 2022 when he took office. His approval rating is now at 33%. Those were your headlines for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 482. I'm Richard McCall, back in Bogota after several weeks in the soporific heat of Mompox. My very special guest this week is no less than Sebastián Ospina. Now, he may not be a household name to many of you, but he is really a Colombian hero in the world of, how do we say it? Parapentism. He is in Switzerland where he lives. He's been a Colombian champion. He's won the Open, the North American Open. He's won the British Open for parapente. Well, let's just say, I mean, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast, Sebastián.
Richard, thanks for the invitation. I'm very excited to have a nice chat with you.
Yeah. Now, you've got great English, and I understand that you lived in England for quite some time. You're originally from, like, Armenia, but you've lived in England, and now you're living in Switzerland.
Yeah, so I grew up in Armenia, Quindío. Then at the age of 17, I moved to the UK, where I lived in London for a bit. Then I lived in Brighton as well. And eventually I got fed up of not having mountains nearby and moved to the Swiss Alps in 2014, I think. It's great.
Well, of course. I mean, we don't even really have mountains in the British Isles. What are called mountains? They're not really mountains when they're compared to the Andes in Colombia, or even, you know, let's say the rolling hills in the Eje Cafetero. For someone who loves and lives through paragliding and parasending and parapente and everything else, you have to have hills. So Switzerland sounds like a good idea.
Absolutely. I don't regret that decision for even a minute. I really enjoy being here. However, the UK was a great place to be. I really love the people, the sense of humor, and actually flying there was not too bad when you had the right weather.
Yeah,
well, the problem is having the right weather.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't go. Yeah, well, true. I used to parasend a fair bit back when I was a teenager. We used to go out to Wales for some of their hills, and that was fun. But then I stopped. I had an accident in Bolivia over Lake Titicaca. That was another one that I was like, I don't really want to repeat. I'll find that film somewhere. Someone's got it recorded. But so tell us a little bit, Sebastián. It's an amazing possibility. It's an amazing opportunity you've had, is to become a professional athlete in this sport. And how do you get involved in this from the very, I mean, I guess you started aged 14 back where where you're from, but how do you get spotted as by someone saying, you know, you are going to be good at this. This is the way you should go. Or is it just, getting involved in competitions? How does it work?
That's a good question. So I learned to fly at a very young age, much earlier than the average person. So when you learn something when you're young, you kind of pick up on things a little bit quicker and better. I did my first competition at age 16, and I did pretty well straight away. I didn't expect that. So that certainly gave me the urge to keep competing. Mm-hmm. However, my mother, she told me that I would not be leaving from paragliding, that I had to study. In a way, she was right, because what she saw at the time is that paragliding was not really a very stable job, and that I wouldn't have much of a future if I did it. So, okay, fair enough. I went to the UK. I did my studies. I studied television production. While I was studying, I was still doing my competitions, became Colombian champion. And I would say that from that moment is when I started to get noticed a bit more. And I got approached by the biggest paragliding magazine out there, Cross Country Magazine. And they offered to sponsor me a little bit, you know, with registration fees and merch and whatever they could help out with. And thus it started doing more competitions and getting more and more noticed. But it was a very slow process, yeah. I would say. It took me more years than many people to get to where I am, but it has been a very steady, steady-paced process. Yeah.
So were you able to like work in TV production and do competitions? I mean, you were able to exercise some of the stuff you studied and make your mother happy?
So not really, not much. I finished my studies in 2013. I must have worked for maybe two or three projects out there in London. And then I pretty much decided to take, let's say, a gap summer, like a sabbatical summer in the Alps. I came over to the Alps and I had a lot of flying done. I learned to fly the Alps even better. And eventually I decided I wanted to stay. So I found the opportunity to get the tandem license, fly passengers out here, fly lots of tourists. So I got the tandem license. I got a job straight away and decided to stay here in Switzerland, in Interlaken. And it's been a really good journey. First of all, because where I live is quite a hub for champions. So, you know, there are many former world champions around me. So a lot of people that I can learn from. Mm. Very intricate conditions that push me to understand the aerology and the meteorology and everything a little better. So it really helped to shape the pilot I am, but it's a lot thanks to being able to work here, for sure, yeah.
I want to get into that in a little bit, but I'm fascinated by the idea that, you know, I assume, you know, it's kind of one of these extreme sports where companies, like you said, the magazine saw you, offered to sponsor you. It's good. It's a good income. Obviously, not enough to live on, but it helps you with the registration and stuff. Do you get people like who get sponsorship from big companies like Red Bull? Because I know they get involved in these kind of things, or I don't know, maybe. Are there other companies such as like Nike or Adidas or sports retailers? Because, you know, I guess this is what you aim for, isn't it? The big sponsorship deals.
Yeah, they used to happen a bit more than they do now. And for sure, Red Bull is probably the main sponsor for individual athletes. Mm-hmm. There are a handful of athletes that are sponsored by Red Bull. For sure, they look at, how media friendly are you and what kind of projects are you to push. So they don't only look at competitions, but they're also looking adventurous spirits, people that, you know, can really show you a good moment on the camera. So Red Bull is definitely one of them. I would say the other main brands, not so much. It's really hard to sell paragliding, to be honest. Most people don't understand it.
It's not, I mean, no, it's not a mass sport. I mean, it's not a massive, massive sport. So,
It's not a massive sport, and it's not something people can relate to. So, for instance, football, people can relate to it pretty easily because anyone can kick the ball. But it's basically that. And paragliding, you have to get a license. It's all very intricate. You have to understand the weather, aerodynamics, and so on and so on. So most people don't understand what's going on in the sky. They just see a pretty thing going on, but not much further than that. So because of that, it's quite hard to find sponsors outside of the paragliding niche.
Yeah.
And in fact, my sponsors are in the paragliding niche. So I'm currently sponsored still by this magazine, by Cross Country. And I recently got support also from the biggest paragliding brand, also on paragliders. But it's those are the main ones, really. Like, it's a very niche thing to do. Of course, if you are trying to push projects or movies or this type of things, you stand a chance to get like a one-off with a big company. But the big sponsorships, aside from Red Bull, don't seem to last too long because of people not understanding what's going on too much.
So you have to be media friendly, you have to be photogenic, you have to be very skilled. There's a whole load of things here that apply if you're going to get the sponsorship. Fortunately, you've got the sponsorship. So that leads me to say, what happens to when you retire from competitions, what happens to you as a paraglider?
Well, competitions are actually more of an opportunity cost for me than they are like my main income.
Okay.
So let's say it's basically my hobby, really. I don't live from competitions. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. Sometimes I wish I did. But in other ways, I'm happy I don't. So my main source of income is just basically flying tourists year-round here in Interlaken, in Switzerland.
Okay.
Where I can choose to work whenever I want, and very flexible, so I can take time away to do competitions. And the comps are just more or less my pastime, my way to stay current, to my motivation, and my way to learn, to keep engaged.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit of income, but not very significant.
So how much, for example, for you won the British Open in 2019, and we'll ask you about the different disciplines in a minute, but if you win the British Open, how much is the prize money for that kind of thing?
Zero.
No!
Yeah.
What about the North American? You won the North American. Surely they give you some money.
No, zero.
So
zero, yeah.
What?
I think the most I've won from a competition, let me just try and think. I went to some random competition in Guatemala where I got $2,000 for being third. And it was basically a very tiny competition, more or less low level. And someone with good money wanted to help out the sport. And even I got an invitation, so I didn't have to pay for anything. That's the most fair game. So really, there is no money prizes in the sport.
Yeah.
And if there is any money coming in, it's mainly from sponsors or something like that.
So you went to Guatemala, and I guess they've got you to go off the volcanoes.
I wish we have gone off a volcano, but I did fly over a volcano
okay.
at some point with one of the flights, which was amazing.
That's what I could imagine, is that somewhere the volcano is, because again, the mountains aren't that big there. You know, okay, so you obviously, your income is taking tourists and so on. Now, obviously, all of us have seen images and film of paragliding, because of course it's just one of it's very visual, and we see TikTok and we see YouTube and we see everything else, but people do not understand the complexity of understanding the weather. And I think you're in a place like Interlaken, obviously mountainous, they're all different types of thermals and wind speeds and variables. I sometimes, when I look at some of these videos, they make me feel a bit queasy, because I just think when you're getting closer to the mountain walls and stuff, there must be a whole different set of rules when it comes to the weather and how to control it. Perhaps you could tell us a bit, you know, when we see these really, what look to be really risky flights next to the mountain walls or cliff walls, what's going through your head?
Well, what's going through my head is, don't die, basically.
Yeah, I imagine that.
But it's very engaging, because how can I say, I'm more afraid of the easy flights than mm-hmm. I am of this sketchy looking terrain, because I know when I fly next to these cliffs or some glacier somewhere in the Alps, I know I'm so engaged into survival mode that most likely nothing would happen, because I will not let something happen. And on the other hand, if you are flying, let's say, over some beautiful coffee plantations in Armenia or something like this, and it's all looking pretty nice and mellow, and that to me is more dangerous, because you can become a bit more complacent and relax a bit much and not care too much. And I've seen really bad things happen when conditions are easy, when the day is easy, precisely because people get complacent. So when I'm flying next to these rocky walls, I'm just thinking of surviving while enjoying the moment, while keeping an eye and analyzing absolutely everything around me regarding winds, maybe other paragliders, cables, clouds, my own glider, and it's so engaging that it's quite addictive, actually, because you enter into some sort of state of flow where you are purely focused on that thing and nothing else in the world.
Have you ever thought about visiting or even moving to Colombia's lush and welcoming Coffee Axis? We at Coffee Axis Travel can provide a personalized service from before your arrival to guide you through the process of setting up a new life here in Colombia's coffee region. We will help you find a place to live, help you navigate contracts and leases, advise you on your visa application and how to open a bank account, and more. With over 10 years of experience in this region, Erin Donaldson, originally from Reno, Nevada, can provide unrivaled knowledge about an area in which she is unashamedly passionate. Check out www.coffeeaxistravel.com for further information on half-day or full-day lifestyle tours and any bespoke consulting required in setting up your new life in Colombia. That's www.coffeeaxistravel.com, where you can get in touch.
That's very interesting to me, but makes perfect sense that on a day where you let's say mellow out, there could be a more likelihood of an accident, because your mind is not in the right place, because you know you've obviously been captured by the beauty of where you are or something. Now, there are different types of, you know, there is the hang glider. Do you do that as well, hang gliding?
I wish, but it's too many hobbies. So, I've tried it on the tandem. It's amazing. It's such a sensation. It's different to paragliding in the how you feel when you're doing it.
Yeah.
But I think it's very fussy, you know, it's too much hassle.
So I did that once over Rio, but the weirdest for me, it was the hardest thing. I was doing tandem, but it was running off the cliff. That was the bit that I didn't like the most. Whereas when I used to do paragliding, you know, getting the wing lifted up beforehand and then finding the thermal to go, you know, I felt safer straight away rather than jumping off a cliff, because it's not a natural feeling. This is kind of amazing, and you are a really, you've got a whole host of awards and recognitions. I mean the Colombian champion in 2013, like we said, you won the North American Open, which was held in Mexico. You've been on the podium many times, the British Open. What amazes me is that obviously first and foremost there's really no money in it. But secondly, is you know, as Colombian champion, you're not representing. You don't represent Colombia. You represent Great Britain, and that's obviously because you are a British citizen now. But how does it feel to represent a different country to the one in which you were born?
Yeah, that's thanks for asking that question, because it's hard. It was really hard to make that decision. I was when I made the decision to fly for Great Britain, I was doing my best to make it into the Colombian team. I was going to World Cups. I was the only Colombian in a World Cup Super Final. I was absolutely really trying hard, and also negotiating with the local federation because. The way the things were working in Colombia regarding the ranking, I was basically not really allowed to compete anywhere else than Colombia if I wanted to make it into the team. So I thought that was really unfair, and I tried to fight it as much as I could until I just couldn't anymore. One day I came back from the super final, absolutely broke. I came back from Brazil having to borrow money from an ex-girlfriend. And it was just the bottom, you know, hitting rock bottom, calling the federation and asking them, hey, what's going to happen to my ranking? I just went to the super final of the World Cup. And is anything going to happen to my ranking? And like, they say, no. It's going to stay as it is. So that's when I decided, okay, I have no future here. And I think it's a bit unfair. They're not thinking ahead. They want you to be the best in Colombia, not the best in the world. And I thought that was not the way to go. And I switched to the UK. I called the team leader of the British team at the time. I told him about my intentions. I didn't know the guy. And he said, okay, cool. Welcome. Yeah, if you have the points, it's all good. You're welcome. And it was very interesting because I was 24, and then I went to the European Championships in Serbia that same year with the British team.
Yeah.
And the youngest person after me was 40. So it was a bit like going on a holiday with your parents, but multiplied by 3 or 4, you know, it's like, it was so hilarious. So, but ever since there's this new young people that have been motivated to come in and do comps in the UK, and it's growing. We're getting better, and now I've done maybe 4 or 5 world championships with the British team, and in 2021 we were world champions, which is a big accomplishment. And this year we got silver. We had the world championships in France, and the French absolutely destroyed everyone, but they were playing at home. We got silver, so we were still pretty happy with that. We had a few awards. I had to go and dress nicely and go to Piccadilly and get an award by some guy with a black tie or whatever. It's been quite good. And regarding, and I had to come and to be okay with it. And I think in Colombia, at the beginning, there was a bit of a feeling that I was somehow a traitor, and it was really awkward when I would go to, there was a world championship in Colombia, and I had to go there with the British flag, and it was the most awkward thing on the planet. And of course, my heart shrinks a little when I see the Colombian team and when I see that I'm not in it. Yeah, for sure. But I still somehow try to give back. I try to share my knowledge with the top Colombian pilots and be an open book and see how much I can help. And I'm good friends with everybody, and everybody is accepting the fact that I fly for the UK, and everybody's okay with it. And by now, it's quite beautiful. It's all good.
You know, the opportunity was there, and you weren't getting it elsewhere. And it kind of feels a bit like, you know, some of the British Olympic athletes who are born in other countries but then grow up in England. You feel a bit like that, and we're quite good at that. Even, you know, the English national football team and so on. So, you know, it's not a stretch of the imagination, but it does seem to me a bit weird that you should be discriminated against by the Colombian Federation for being international. It seems a bit, and forgive me for saying it, seems a bit parochial, that kind. But, you know, so be it. That's the way they've done it, and it's been their loss, in the British team.
Absolutely. However, like, nowadays things improved in the Colombian Federation, so they changed the ranking. Like, today, if I wanted to compete for the Colombian team, I would be able to. Like,
okay.
I would be competitive. I would be probably top of the ranking by far, no problem, which is totally fair. But at the same time, I cannot be ungrateful with the Brits, with how much I've received and how much I learned from them. And I don't want to change something that is going so well right now. I've had offers. Like, literally, I've had them tell me, hey, we want you to fly again for Colombia. Can we make it happen? What can we do? And they really want me there again. And it's very nice. I try to be nice about it. I try to share my knowledge to help in some other way. But at the moment, I cannot be ungrateful and be just like a flag on the wind, just switching whichever way is more convenient. I think I made my decision, and I'm happy with it for now. Yeah.
Well, as a Brit, I thank you, and I thank you for that kind of. I want to ask you now is, you know, I know that a lot of my listeners won't understand how these competitions work, because surely, it's, you know, my basic feeling is you go up, you enjoy yourself, and you try not to die. So there have to be. We were talking off recording, and you were explaining to me some of the disciplines. Perhaps you could explain the four disciplines for the competitions in paragliding.
Yeah, of course. So the most basic one is basically accuracy paragliding, which is basically taking off. You have a point at the bottom at the landing field. You have to land as close on the point or as close to the point as you can land. And then you get measured on how far you got to the middle point. It could be 1 centimeter, 2, 3, 1 meter, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the competition, they just measure whoever lost the left distance to the point, let's say. So that's accuracy. To me, it's quite basic, but some people enjoy it. And it's very public friendly. So a lot of people like to watch and see the face and, it's kind of interesting.
When you come in on accuracy, it's about landing still in that point, right? It's not like hitting your feet down and then rolling over. You've got to end up in that spot.
Honestly, I don't know.
Okay, it's all right.
It's my least favorite discipline, and I don't look too much into it.
Okay, let's go to discipline number two then.
Then we have aerobatics, which is cool, certainly cool, and it requires a level of training and technicality and, I don't know, commitment that is unbelievable. And in fact, in Colombia, there are two of the best aerobatic pilots on the planet. They are both in the top five in the world. One is Andrés Villamizar and César Arevalo. They are doing amazing things. And they are at the top of the top of the world in aerobatics. It's unbelievable. And basically, you go out there, you do your routine, you have a bunch of maneuvers that you can do. And there are judges that will be qualifying you on the technicality of your maneuver and how clean your maneuver is. Okay. And also, you are not allowed to repeat a maneuver unless you do it on the other side. So it's very technical. If it's a long competition and you are not repeating the maneuver, it can get very complicated. On top of that, they get a score also on the landing. So they need to do a very stylish landing, come with lots of speed, drag the foot on the ground or the water, and then do like a spin at the end or whatever. It's very artistic. I find it quite interesting.
When it's aerobatics like this, acrobatics, is it like doing loops and so on? Is it doing spins and everything? Wow. And then the fear for me then, if you're doing a loop up and over, is that the wing might, you know, fold in on itself.
Exactly. So that's why they have to train so hard, so that that doesn't happen. And sometimes while training, they can even fall inside the canopy, which is the most scary thing on the planet.
Have you done that?
No. I almost died it once, but never in the canopy, thank God. And I hope I die without ever experiencing that.
I'm feeling a bit sick to my stomach thinking about that, you know. Yeah. Oh, my God, no. Okay. And then number three, we've done two. So number three is cross country, I think.
Yeah. So we have cross country, which is the most, let's say, mainstream. And in my opinion, why a paraglider should exist, because a paraglider can cover unbelievable distances. You know, the world record is at 613 kilometers, which is unbelievable.
Wow. I mean,
what you can do with this piece of cloth is amazing. So we do cross-country races, which is like basically we wake up in the morning, drive up to the takeoff place. They give us a route based on the weather situation, and this routes could be somewhere between 45 to 200 kilometers. You have it to complete it in one flight. We all take off within the same hour. Then the race starts. We'll start the race at the same time in the air. Basically, whoever finishes the track in the quickest way possible is the winner. So whoever arrives first is the winner. So for this, you have to really analyze the conditions in unbelievably well. So you have to look at the clouds, how they are forming, are they loading up, are they decaying, how is the wind doing, where are the thermals kicking off, how is the terrain. Then on top of that, you have to look at the other gliders. We are 150 sometimes. And you have to look at the others and make strategic decisions based on what they do as well. To me, it's the most beautiful thing on the planet to do a paragliding race. It's just so engaging and so wonderful. But of course, it's hard to explain to the general public, but it's amazing. It's amazing.
This to me is amazing because, you know, as you say, that however many people up there, it must be really incredible to see so many. But I also wanted to ask, is it a bit like sailing where you can steal the wind from someone else or steal, let's say, the thermal? Is that like illegal to do, like it is in sailing?
No, so that's a good point. Like, yeah, you can not necessarily steal the thermal, but you can win just by following the others. So you can actually, there is someone showing you a thermal, you go there, you climb with that person. You are not stealing it away because that person still has it. But of course, we use others. We use each other. Mm-hmm. In order to progress, it's a bit like we call it chupar rueda, you know, like when the cyclists are just on the behind each other, just so that they don't get as much drag.
Yeah.
We do something similar in paragliding, which is just following each other, so we get a better line. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, the best pilot wins by making their own decisions.
And is there a maximum height you can fly to? I have to ask this because there's so many of you, you've got to find space.
So it really depends on the place, because we have to follow, we have to abide by the, in Colombia, it would be Aerocivil, the aviation authority. So very often they give us limitations because the planes also need to fly. So let's say in Valle del Cauca, on a normal competition, we would be able to climb up to 2,800 meters over the sea level. That would normally be good enough. But sometimes we get limited to a lower altitude, let's say 2,400, which makes things a bit trickier. And then if you break this limit, you get penalized. Mm-hmm. So you have to really take this into account. So each place has their own limitations. Some places have zero limitations, which is amazing, so that you can climb as high as you can. But this is also determined by the meteorology of the day.
Okay. And then discipline number four.
Discipline number four is the fastest growing one, and it's hike and fly. So it's basically a mixture between a cross country race,
yeah,
and a marathon or ultra marathon or whatever it is. So basically, before the event even starts, they set out a route which is quite ambitious. So it could be, I think, minimum is 200 kilometers. And some events are as long as 1,200 kilometers. And basically, again, the winner is the first one to cross the finish line. However, in this race, you can run or fly, nothing else. So that makes things quite interesting, because if you land early for whatever reason, then you can hike up to the closest mountain, find a crazy takeoff place to start from, and then keep going. But this, what makes this race as interesting is that they don't care what the weather is. So if the weather is bad, good, whatever, you still keep going. So for that reason, they can be probably technically the most dangerous, even though the safety numbers are not too bad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's absolutely crazy, because you have to endure whatever nature throws at you, and with the other categories, if the weather is bad, they just cancel the day.
Yeah.
But with this one, it's a bit more fluid. So if the weather is bad, you may end up running the whole day, and some people run up to 100 kilometers in one day with the backpack. So that's 8 kilos, 8 to 10 kilos in the back. So that's incredible. It's more of an adventure race.
Yeah, I like the sound of this. Obviously, no, it's not something I do now, but I do like the sound of it. But it does seem like something that people would take more unnecessary risks in. Like, the weather's bad. Oh, yeah, but I can still get, you know, I can still advance 6 to 10 kilometers even in this weather. You know, maybe it would be just a bit unnecessary on that one, because I wouldn't want to run the 200 kilometers. And this to me sounds like it can take several days, right? So, I mean, are you running day and night, or do you, I mean, people stop, they must stop.
Yeah, you have like a curfew. Normally they have a curfew. So like the race I won locally here last year, the Eiger Tour, and basically I think you have to stop at 8:30 at night. Mm-hmm. And then you find shelter somewhere. They don't care where. Maybe I take a train and go home or whatever. But the next day, But the next day at 6 a.m., you have to start again from the same exact point. So it is quite an adventure, because lots of people end up sleeping up in the mountains, camping out, or finding a hut or a refuge somewhere. And it's pretty sick. It's pretty good.
But you went home.
I have done that a couple of times.
Well, I guess it's a benefit of being in Switzerland, because the trains run on time then, and so So how long is the longest one that you've done then, of the hike and fly?
Not very long. It's not particularly my specialty. My specialty is flying, so I'm not so fast on the ground, which is a big penalty in high altitude flight. I think the longest has been like 240 kilometers in 2.5 days.
It's still a long way, Sebastian. It's yeah. still a long way. And for someone like me who's very much sits at his desk, it's quite hard to understand, but it's amazing. I think this has been absolutely riveting, this conversation, because there's so much here that I just didn't know anything about, you know, especially the different disciplines. You just kind of imagine parasending, paragliding as a you know, like a risky and costly pastime, as you say. But actually, you know, to hear this side of things and the sort of professional side of things and the athlete side of things has been really, really quite special. So I would like to say thank you so much for your time, being on the line with us here from, you know, here in Bogota, there in Switzerland late at night. I also have to say thank you to Jonathan Munoz, who put us in contact. And he wants me to shout out to his friend, who I think flies as well, is Oliver Kutter in Germany or in Switzerland, who is a listener of the podcast. So I have to mention those two. Jonathan and Oliver, thank you so much. Sebastian, thank you for your time. It has been really, I mean, it's been special. I wanted to show you something for those of you who watch on YouTube. Look, here's the Colombian flag, but watch. And there's the Union Jack. I got given this by the British Embassy. So Colombia on one side, Great Britain on the other. So that's very much your flag there. Yeah. And the flag for me when Colombia and England are playing one another. So I have to bring that flag out. Otherwise, it's not. But listen, thank you so much. And thank you to your partner, Juliana, for putting us together. It kind of felt like she was organizing it. for us, but it's been fun, and I know that my listeners will enjoy this one. A Colombian in Switzerland competing for Great Britain, but having won the, you know, Colombia, having been the world champion in Colombia. I mean, there's all sorts of things here. It's just very special to hear a nice story of this type. So thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you, Richard, for giving me this space, and I love what you do, and keep on doing it. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. We shall keep on. Emily and myself, we shall keep on. This has been episode 482. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If, of course, you want to support us, that's www.patreon.com/ColombiaCalling. And now we'll go over to a couple of messages from our sponsors. But thank you, everyone, for listening again, and bye-bye. The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors. Yeah.
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.